Board, Andrew. Okay, so we're looking at this question. I want to just look at this question. Can we trust the Gospels? I wonder if anyone's ever heard of the Da Vinci Code. It was big a few years ago. It's a book by Dan Brown, which questioned the reliability of the Gospels. It was a bit of a sort of a story as well. I listened to it. I didn't watch it. It was a film as well. And one prominent atheist claimed that the only difference between the Da Vinci Code and the Gospels was that the Gospels were ancient fiction and the Da Vinci Code was modern fiction. So he said it was just in the same sort of category of fiction. One was modern, one is ancient, but they're just the same. And books like the Da Vinci Code and other codes also books also introduce us to the fact that there were other so-called gospels coming from the early centuries, other writings that people sometimes point to and say, well, do you know what? You read Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, but what about the Gospel of Judas, or the Gospel of Thomas, or the Gospel of Philip? These gospels that are made popular, they're sort of the come up in the news from time to time, or there might be an article in them about them. How do we know that our gospels, the gospels that we read, aren't just stories invented at a later time and in another place? How do we know that they're genuine? How do we know that they're trustworthy? How do we know that these are the ones that we should be reading rather than some of these others? And is there an answer to people who say that the gospels are just made up? How might we answer? Well, the best answer to people like that is to encourage them to read the Bible, to read the Gospels, because the Bible is God's word, and God is quite able to open people's eyes to its truthfulness. But there are lots of other answers too, because the claims that the Gospels are made up, the claims that they're just stories invented at a later time and in another place, just doesn't fit what we see, what we actually have. Like I mentioned this morning, this past week, I read this book, Can We Trust the Gospels, by Pete Williams, and I heard him give a lecture on the subject, and I was very enthused about it. I thought I'd share just some of the highlights. It's a great book. It's not too long. It took me 2 hours to read. I've read it before, so it wasn't such new things, but I'm a slow reader. Quite demanding. But let me just share some highlights. Now, we need to be understand that these things that Pete draws out, the things I'm going to say, don't prove the truthfulness of the Gospels. Because nothing outside of the Bible can prove the Bible's truthfulness. If it did, then we would be saying that something outside the Bible was more reliable than the Bible. We'd be saying that we get proof of the reliability of the Bible from outside. But we don't want to say that. If the Bible is God's word, then there won't be anything more reliable than it to prove it. But what these things do is that they show us that many people's ideas about the Gospels or claims or criticisms just don't stack up. The Gospels are full of little clues that reassure us and encourage us. And the idea that the Gospels were made up by people who lived years later and far away just doesn't fit the data. And so I want us just to look at some examples of that this afternoon. We'll see how far we get, how many we get along with. But let's make it interactive. So you might want to knock off your mutes. I'm certainly going to ask a few questions. It's going to be quiet if they're all rhetorical. So imagine you're writing a story. You're writing a story about events in a different place which you've never visited. And the first thing you need is some places for your action. So we're going to ask the question, how's your geography? Imagine you were going to write a story about Iran. Now, Ellie's not allowed to answer this question, but for anyone else who's never been to Iran, can you give me a name of a place in Iran?
Tehran.
Tehran, is that right? Yeah, that's the capital. Okay, right, that's the easy one. Let's have some more then.
Isfahan.
Okay, we've got another one from Philip. Any more? maybe just some sort of small villages for you know, because we don't want it just in the capital. We want, you see, we're struggling, aren't we? Now you might say, but that's easy, Phil. We'll just Google. We'll just pull up a map. But obviously, there's no internet research in the ancient world. You just can't go down to your local library and find a list of these places. So how do the other Gospels, these sort of contender Gospels, do with geography? The Gospel of Thomas mentions Judea once in the whole of the Gospel. Now, the Jewish people were called Judeans, so this isn't really very impressive. The Gospel of Judas has no locations in it at all, not a single one. The Gospel of Philip mentions Jerusalem four times. Now, that's like us getting Tehran, I guess. That's the big place, the place that if you've heard of anywhere, you might have heard of. And it mentions Nazareth. But that's not that impressive, because the followers of Jesus were called Nazarenes. And so it uses a word like Nazareth, and it mentions the Jordan, a river. So, okay, let's give some, that's the best that the Gospel of Philip can do. What about our Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John? Well, this is a completely different kettle of fish. We have 26 towns that are mentioned in the Gospels. And they're not all in one. It's not as if they're all in Matthew, and so Mark, Luke, and John can copy. Magadan is only mentioned in Matthew. Dalmanutha is only mentioned in Mark. Emmaus and Nain are only mentioned in Luke. Anon and Cana and Ephraim and Salem and Sychar are only mentioned in John. And yet there are other towns that are mentioned in two of the Gospels or three of the Gospels, Jerusalem, and other key areas mentioned in all of the Gospels. But you can see how different this is. Just one mention or two mention of the big place that we've heard of compared to the details. And some of these are bigger, some of these are smaller. Some of the most key places are not mentioned in the Gospels. Now, if you were making up a story, you'd use all the information you had. I didn't learn for many, many years that one of the biggest towns, the capital of up in the north, was called Sepphoris. I've never heard of Sepphoris. Sepphoris isn't in the Gospels. But that's because there's no action in Sepphoris. And so the Gospel writers don't need to mention it. But if you were sort of desperately looking for places that you'd heard of, the bigger places, the key places would get mentioned. And then there's tiny little places like Chorazin, which was on the road to Bethsaida. And there is no literary source known to us in the ancient world where you could find that name. You just have to dig up a pot that has it on, as it were, or you just have to live in the vicinity or talk to someone who has a very clear knowledge of the area. But it's not just towns in the Gospels. There's 26 towns, there's 13 regions mentioned, there's five bodies of water, and there are other places, seven other places, even gardens, individual gardens. If you were going to write your fictional account set in Iran, I wonder how well you'd do if you had to start now without any research. And so we see here that John mentions here in John chapter 5, now there is in Jerusalem by the sheep gate a pool in Aramaic called Bethesda, which has five roofed colonnades. For many centuries, people criticized John and said it was just made up. You know, people say that John is the latest of the writers, the least reliable, often he's criticized, and this was just invented until it was discovered. And so we see John is accurate. He knows about the sheep gate, he knows about the pool, he knows about the five roofed colonnades in the pool. Okay, so there's geography. But it's even more than that. Now, we need to remember what we're saying here is that this doesn't prove that everything that's in the Gospels is true. What it does is it shows us that the idea that they were just invented at a later time and in another place just doesn't fit the facts. Each of the Gospel writers has a variety of places, some of them well-known, lesser-known, very obscure, and each has unique information and a variety. But there's something cooler than that, ups and downs. Let's talk about ups and downs. Imagine I was going to write a story set in Islington. I left Highbury Baptist Church after the morning meeting and walked up to the Emirates Stadium. What would you think about that? Do I know my Islington?
Well, you've given us the clue. No.
I don't. Well, because you don't walk up to the Emirates Stadium from Highbury Baptist Church. You walk down to the Emirates Stadium. Now, even if you had a map of the area, even if you knew those two places, you wouldn't know that, would you? How about this one? I left Chipping Sodbury and walked down to Yate. Now then, does anyone know if that's true or not?
True.
It's true. It's true because Chipping Sodbury is higher up than Yate, but you only know it if you've been to Chipping Sodbury and Yate. Those who've never been there would never know that. This is a sort of level of information that shows a real familiarity with a place. I think about Matthew, Mark, Luke and John. All of us tell us that you go up to Jerusalem and that you go down from Jerusalem. Jerusalem is high up. It's set high above sea level. But you might say, well, that's because it's the capital. And we might even talk about going up. You might say, I'm going up to London. I'm going up to London from Leeds. It's down. What might you say? Well, what about this one then? A man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho, and he fell among robbers who stripped him and beat him and departed, leaving him half dead. Now, by chance, a priest was going down that road. And when he saw him, he passed by on the other side. The road from Jerusalem to Jericho, is that uphill or is that downhill? It's downhill because Jericho is the lowest city on earth, 250 meters below sea level. It's not underwater, but just the shape and the way that the landscape is. That's absolutely right. But how about this one? After this, after the wedding in Cana, Jesus went down to Capernaum because Cana is higher up than Capernaum. Or Luke 4:31, and from Nazareth, Jesus went down to Capernaum, a city of Galilee. All of these ups and downs are right. They're in and they're right. Again, it encourages us. It reminds us that the gospel writers knew their locations. They didn't just know about the places, but they even knew whether you went up or down to get to a place. Very striking. This is not the sort of information that you would have if you were making a story up, or even the sort of information that you would have if you were just half remembering a story that someone else told, that someone else told, that someone else told. This is high quality information that we have in the Gospels, which we can verify by looking at the geography, but the sort of thing that you couldn't find out from outside. The only way you could know it was either if you were familiar or if you talked in detail with someone who knew the situation. But even more interesting than geography, even more interesting than the ups and the downs, are the names of people. So imagine you're going to write a story. Let's write a story that's in France. Let's write a story set in Paris around 1900. So we'll have some guys in our story. Who are we going to have in our story? Let's have some suggestions. Any French names?
Pierre.
We're going to have Pierre. Anyone else?
John.
Victor. Maybe Victor.
Guillaume.
If you did your research, which of course you couldn't do in the first century, you would know that Jean, Louis, Pierre, and Joseph were the top French names. And so we got a Pierre, didn't we? But then we've got far more information than the people had back then if they were writing at a distance. But there are names. 20% of people were called one of those four names in France in around the turn of the 20th century. Now, a scholar called Richard Borkum has done a study, an exhausting study, on the names in the area in the ancient world at the time of the first century when Jesus lived, based on the Dead Sea Scrolls, information that was dug up with names in, based on the famous historian Flavius Josephus, based on early rabbinic writings, based on ossuaries. What's an ossuary? Does anyone know what an ossuary is?
Box of bones.
It's a box of bones. So there's your box of bones. I guess it's a bit like the cemetery with the sort of names on the gravestones or the names on the crematorium on the little plaques. But ossuaries have names on. And so he got a list of all of these names, all of the names from all of these sources, and found out how many different people with each name there was, and made a sort of master list of popular names. So these were the names, the most common names in Israel at the time. Here are the top six names in Israel. So Simon, there were 243 Simons that Borkum dug up, as it were, in his research. There was 218 Josephs. There was 166 Eliezers or Lazarus. That was pretty much basically the same name. You can see the Lazara in it. It's the sort of same name. There was 164 Judas, 122 Johannans, that's like our John, and 99 Joshuas or Jesuses. Now, those are the top six, top seven. They, as more information is found, they sort of, you might go up or down a place. Do you know what I mean? Judah, a couple more Judas dug up in boxes, and he would be in number three. But we get the idea, don't we? These are the top names from Israel. Imagine doing that. Imagine that was your day job. But that was Richard Borkum, to whom we should be very, very grateful. Now, here are where those names come in the New Testament. There are eight Simons in the New Testament. There are six Josephs in the New Testament. There's a Lazarus. There's not fictional characters, but real characters. There's five Judas. There's five Johns, and there's two Joshuas, Jesuses, probably two or maybe three. Now, can you see that there's the same sort of ratios? There's a lot of Simons, because there's a lot of Simons at the time. There's a lot of Josephs. Because there's a lot of Josephs. You know, the poor old Lazarus hasn't got that representation that he might have hoped for. Obviously, there just weren't enough mixing and meeting with the people in the New Testament. But Judas, just a few less Judas. There's a few less Judas in the New Testament. Johannes, Johns. And then Joshua, Jesus, these top six. We have two of those. Now, can you see how... Imagine if you were trying to make up a story... Imagine going back to our story of France in the 1900s. Would we have chosen the names that were accurate? But would we have got the right number of multiple named people? It's quite remarkable, isn't it? That's a particular piece of information. About one in six people is called Simon or Joseph. In Richard Borkum's research, about one in six people is called Simon or Joseph in the New Testament. Now, this is talking about men. About 40% of men had one of the top nine names, so there wasn't as much variety as we have now. About 40%, do you know what I mean? So if you get a group of your 10 men starting a synagogue, then we're talking about Jewish names here, 10 men starting the synagogue, four of them are likely to come in those top nine. And we have exactly the same ratio in the New Testament. There's less information about women's names, but Mary was the big popular one. And we know how much trouble we have with Marys in the Gospels, trying to know which is which. And Salome was popular as well. We have a Salome in the Gospels. So imagine you were going to write a story about us. So we've thought about our Iranian story. We've thought about our French story. Imagine you were going to write a story which was set in the land of Israel today. Okay, so it's quite a bit of a sort of nervous time in the land of Israel. I wonder what names you would use for that story. Imagine you're not allowed to do any research. you might think to yourself, well, I know what I'll do. I'll go over to Golders Green and I'll do a bit of a poll and I'll find out about the Jewish names in Golders Green. And that'll give me some great ideas, Jewish folks. There's, you know, a real Jewish community there. And that'll give me some good idea of the names and what are the popular names. And then I'll write my story. Does that sound like a plan? That sounds like a good plan, doesn't it? So imagine there are places elsewhere in the ancient Near East with huge Jewish communities, particularly Alexandria. Alexandria had a huge Jewish community. So maybe the Gospels were written. We know that we've got some copies of the Gospels from Egypt. Most of our copies of the Gospel don't come from Israel. They come from all around about. It shows how the message spread. But imagine they were written in Egypt. Well, fortunately, Mr. Borkum has done us a favor of telling us about the top popular Jewish names in Egypt. And here they are. Eliezer, Sabbatius, Joseph, Dosisthius, Pappus, and Ptolemais. So if you were an Egyptian Jew, then those were the top six. Those were the ones that you were scratching your head. Those were the ones you were going to choose for your firstborn and get in there, the first one in the family with a Sabbatius. But you notice only two of them match up with the top names in Israel. So even though it's a Jewish community, the names are completely different, apart from Eliezer and Joseph. But we don't have any Dosisthiuses in the Gospels. We don't have a Pappus or a Ptolemais or a Sabbatius, because they reflect the Palestinian, the Israeli Jewish community names. Now, what about one of these other Gospels? How about the Gospel of Judas? Now, remember, the Gospel of Judas didn't do very well on its locations. But what about its names? Well, it's got Jesus in. But you would expect that. And it's got Judas in. But you would expect that from the Gospel of Judas. And it has no other reasonable Palestinian Jewish names. It's got Adam and Barbello and Gabriel and Michael and Nebro and Saklas and Sophia and Yobel, none of which have any sort of connection. I don't think they've even made it onto Borkum's list. They're sort of invented names. When we have, once again, this, we need to remember, this isn't proving the truthfulness of the Gospels, but what it's showing is that the idea that they were invented, or the idea that there are some other contender Gospels, it just doesn't fit the facts. These other sort of contenders, when we look into the sort of quality of the information, we find that there's nothing to compare. So there we are. So it's not hard to see which one is a fake. And you also think about our Gospels. Imagine J.K. Rowling sat down to write Harry Potter, and she thought to herself, what should we call Harry's best friend? Let's call him Harry Weasley. Now, that would be an absolute nightmare for a story, wouldn't it? That would not help you. And yet, what do we have in our Gospels? They're covered with Marys. We've got Simons. That's because it's how it was, not because it being invented. But there's something even cooler. Let's talk about disambiguation. Disambiguation, what does that mean? Well, imagine we put these prayer points up on a Wednesday night. Here's our prayer points. Andrew Murray is preaching. These are just imaginary. Andrew Murray is preaching. Let's pray for Cindy's neighbour. Let's pray for Rania at school. And let's pray for Philip Hill, who is unwell. Well, we are praying for Philip. Now, have you noticed something about those names? Andrew Murray has a surname. And Philip Hill has a surname. But Cindy and Rania don't have surnames. Why is that?
There are two. And two Phillips.
There are two Phillips. And?
Two Andrews.
Two Andrews. So there are certain names that we need to disambiguate in our church. If we were talking about grace, we need anti-grace or Grace King and so forth. Why do some people get extra descriptors? Because the most common names need explanations, okay? And that's exactly what we find in the Gospels. Let me give you And that's true in general. I mean, this is a description about our church, but in general, if you were talking about someone, if he's got a common name, you might have to explain which of the person you were talking about. But if it's a familiar name, if it was a rare name, then just a name would do. So here is the words from Matthew chapter 10. The names of the 12 apostles are first these. And look, what I've done is I've put in how popular the names are. Remember, Simon was the most popular name. The popular names, the top dozen names or so, I've put in it green. And the very rare names where they come on the list are in red. So the names of the 12 apostles are these. First, Simon, who is called Peter. Well, obviously, we need to know which Simon you're talking about because everyone's called Simon. And Andrew, his brother, well, we don't need to be told it's his brother, but that's an interesting piece of information for us. James, but which James? James is up there. There's lots of Jameses. Ah, James, the son of Zebedee. And John. And we need to know which John, because John's a popular member, so number five. John, his brother. Philip, not many Philips. And Bartholomew, not many Bartholomews. Thomas, that's rare. And Matthew, the tax collector. See, Matthew the tax collector gets a label. Now, perhaps up until now you thought Matthew the tax collector is labeled because isn't it really interesting that Matthew was a tax collector? Well, it is really interesting, but the reason he's got a label is that Matthew is a common name. James, here's another James, to James the son of Alphaeus, and Thaddeus. Now, Thaddeus may have had a really interesting job, but he's just not got a popular name. So we don't need to find out about that job. Simon, there's another Simon, Simon the Zealot. Every Simon has to be Simon the something because there's so many of them. And Judas Iscariot, because Judas is name number four, Judas who betrayed him. So you might say, well, clearly Simon and James need to have things after them because they're the most popular. The fact that they're the most popular just reinforces the fact that that's who we'd expect amongst Jesus's disciples. But the fact that Matthew has and Judas have extras is quite striking because they are popular names. So you see that, and we see this again and again in the Gospels. John the Baptist. If John the Baptist had been called Thomas or if he'd have had one of those bizarre Egyptian names, if he'd have been Sabbatius, we probably would never have called him John the Baptist. He would just have been Sabbatius. But because John was up there with common names, he's also always known as John the Baptist. And it's even true of Jesus. We need to remember that Jesus was a common name. Joshua, Yeshua, Jesus, it's all the same name. It's a common name. There are at least two of them in the New Testament. There's the Jesus, and there's Jesus called Justice in Colossians chapter 1. And there may be another Jesus, because some manuscripts say that Barabbas was called Jesus Barabbas. Sure, they're not. You can see why someone might leave that piece of information out, because it makes things very complicated and confusing. Jesus Barabbas, possibly, because it was a common name. Now, when we read the Gospels and it mentions Jesus, we don't worry about who it's talking. If you need to check which Jesus it's talking about, you probably haven't been paying attention to the Gospels. But when people talk about Jesus in the Gospels, they always disambiguate him. When Jesus entered Jerusalem, the whole city was stirred up saying, "Who is this?" And the crowd said, "This is the prophet Jesus from Nazareth of Galilee." He's Jesus of Nazareth. That's his name. Jesus of Nazareth, not Jesus Christ. That's not his surname. That means Messiah Jesus. And he's not called that till the letters, but he's Jesus of Nazareth to differentiate him from all the other Jesuses who are around and about that you happen to know. Jesus, the stonemason, and Jesus, the fisherman, and Jesus, the scribe, or whatever it is. This is Jesus from Nazareth. Or Matthew 26, Peter was sitting outside in the courtyard. Servant girl came up to him and said, "You also were with Jesus the Galilean." But he denied it before them all, saying, "I do not know what you mean." And when he went out to the entrance, another servant girl saw him, and she said to the bystanders, "This man was with Jesus of Nazareth." He needs a disambiguator because it's a common name. Now, that didn't happen later on. If you go later on through history, Jesus was no longer a common name, unsurprisingly, because he was such a famous person. And so there was this sense in which it was the Jesus. But when you go back to the Gospel times, he needs a disambiguator. The angel said to the woman, "Do not be afraid, for I know that you seek Jesus, who was crucified." Whenever Jesus is mentioned, as it were, in the third person, he's disambiguated. And yet not later on. I mean, to use a very sort of a very unsuitable analogy, and yet one which I think makes the points. If you were to talk at the beginning, early in the 20th century, to a German about Adolf, they'd ask you, which Adolf? You'd have to say Adolf the this or Adolf the that. But after the middle of the 20th century, you didn't need to ask which Adolf it was. You see how a name comes into prominence. And so it shows us again that the Gospels are recording memories of the very time. They're not inventions from later on. How are we doing? A little bit more. Author's fingerprints. Now, none of the Gospels have the names attached to them. None of them start. They're not like the letters of Paul, which say Paul, an apostle. None of the Gospels have the name attached to them, but tradition, early tradition, joins them to Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Now we can figure out Luke and John. We can figure out Luke as the writer of Luke, but it's quite hard work. We need to realize that Luke wrote Acts, and we can work that out. And then we can look at the times when Luke joins the company of Paul, and suddenly he talks about we do this or we do that. A very subtle thing, but we can sort of, or certainly we've got this good evidence, corroboration that Luke is in fact, and the same is true of John. It's even more difficult, but with John, the disciple that Jesus loved, we can do a similar thing, but not with Matthew and Mark. And it's very interesting, Mark and Luke, Matthew and John were disciples. Mark and Luke were not disciples, and therefore there doesn't seem to be any reason why their names would be attached to these Gospels. They're not put onto the Gospels to give them an authority because they weren't disciples. So there's every good reason to trust the names that we add to our Gospels. But who were they? Who was Matthew? He was a tax collector from Capernaum. Who was Mark? Well, Mark was a spokesman for Peter. This seems to be the case. We read about Mark in Acts, John Mark, but it seems that he's telling the story from Peter's point of view. Peter the fisherman from Bethsaida. Who was Luke? Luke was a doctor. Luke was perhaps the only Gentile amongst the crew. Luke was a traveller. He may have been from Antioch. And John was a fisherman in Galilee. Now, That's what we know about these writers. This seems very sensible to understand them. Now, here's a little piece of information. John was a fisherman. Peter was a fisherman. Andrew was a fisherman. James was a fisherman. Where did they fish? Who can tell me where they fished? Did they fish in the Med? Lena's going to tell us.
In Galilee, was it?
That's interesting. Where did they fish? Matthew, Mark, and John consistently tell us that they fished on the Sea of Galilee. Usually they just call it the sea. They call it the Sea of Galilee when they first introduce it. Matthew and Mark, John introduces it in full detail, the Sea of Galilee of Tiberias, but it's a big city. But the Sea of, they usually just call it the sea because it was the sea. That was where they did all of their fishing. They grew up. Matthew grew up in Capernaum, or was a tax collector from Capernaum, on the coast, or on the shores of the sea. Peter, fisherman, from the shores of the sea. This is where they did all of their fishing. What does Luke call it? Luke calls it the lake. Why does Luke call it the lake? Because Luke's a traveller, and Luke has seen the real sea. Luke knows the Mediterranean, and so instinctively, he wouldn't call this little poxy bit of water tucked away in the middle of, that's a lake, guys, that's a lake. You know, the sea is the sea, it's the men. Isn't that interesting? That's not the sort of thing that you would just invent, or it's just a natural thing that comes out. And yet we see something of the author's fingerprints in the documents. We also could notice that the Gospels are full of criticisms of the disciples who became the leaders in the early church. If you were going to invent a story, why invent a story that makes you look bad? Two more examples and two more things before we finish. The next one is up a gum tree. So let's think a little bit about the story of Zacchaeus from Luke chapter 19 and verses 1 to 10. Now, who can tell me Zacchaeus's job? What did Zacchaeus do? Someone else. What was Zacchaeus's job?
He was a tax collector.
He was a tax collector. Can we be some more specific?
He's a chief tax collector.
He was a chief tax collector. He was a chief tax collector. That meant that he was in charge of lots of tax collectors. Okay. Now, can anyone else think of anywhere in the Gospels where we have a whole group of tax collectors?
In the temple.
Well, they're a different bunch. They're taking your money. They're money changers, but they're not tax collectors. But it's a good idea. A bunch of tax collectors, not just one.
Any? Was it when Matthew had a party?
Matthew had a party. As Jesus passed on from there, he saw a man called Matthew sitting at the tax booth, and he said to him, "Follow me." And he rose and followed him. And as Jesus reclined at table in the house, behold, many tax collectors and sinners came and were reclining with Jesus and his disciples. Now, this is interesting. Our picture of Matthew in the Gospels is rather different from our picture of Matthew from The Chosen. Here's Matthew with his whole collection of tax collector friends. Where did Zacchaeus live? Jericho. Where was Matthew from? Capernaum. Jericho and Capernaum were both on the boundary between territories. They were the sort of place where you would have lots of people coming and going, passing through. It's where you needed multiple tax collectors. It's just a little thing. It's just a mention. That's where you know Capernaum, you tax the fish and you're moving from one of those tetrarch regions to another. Jericho, you're moving in into one region. Just a little thing. It's you can't say this proves the truthfulness of the Gospels, but what it does is it's just one more of those evidences of how reliable all the details are. What else do we know about Zacchaeus?
He was little.
He was small, yeah. Anything else?
Not many friends.
Not many friends, probably, almost rich. Certainly. Rich.
He was a climber.
Yeah, he was a climber. He climbed a tree. What sort of tree did he climb?
Sycamore.
He ran ahead and climbed a sycamore fig tree. Now, it's very interesting that Jericho has sycamore fig trees. But you wouldn't know that Jericho had sycamore fig trees if you lived outside of the area. You don't have sycamore fig trees all over the ancient world, but you do have them in Jericho. It's just another little piece of information, a little detail. Now, it's interesting. Jesus, where was Jesus going when he met Zacchaeus? Where was he heading?
To Jerusalem.
He was heading to Jerusalem. Well, if he was heading to Jerusalem, what on earth was he going through Jericho for? Because Jericho lies to the east of Jerusalem, whereas Jesus was coming surely from the north, from Galilee. So why would he go through Jericho? Does anyone know? Well, a lot of good it would be if you were writing the Gospels. But fortunately, the people who wrote the Gospels knew that the Jews when travelling from the north of the country to the south, didn't go directly through Samaria, but they went round down the Jordan River, down the east side of the Jordan River, and across from the east to the west, through Jericho, on the way to Jerusalem. You see, just these little pieces of information, these little details, the like of which you do not get in the Gospel of Thomas, which only mentions Judea once. You see the level, the quality of the information. One more little thing, just as an example, food for thought. Let's think a little bit about the feeding of the 5,000. This just shows us how the gospel accounts fit together and make sense of each other in very subtle and little ways. The sort of ways, these are things called undesigned coincidences. Little things, I'll give you a couple of examples. We might think of Mary and Martha. Mary and Martha. In Luke's gospel, Martha is the active one, and Mary is the one who sat at Jesus' feet. When John tells a completely different story about Mary and Martha, about the death of their brother Lazarus, what do we find? We find that when Jesus is on his way, Martha, the active one, is the one who goes out to meet him. It's just a little tiny thing. Or we might think of James and John, and one of the Gospels tells us that James and John get the nickname the Sons of Thunder. Another Gospel tells us that they were the ones who asked Jesus to call down fire from heaven on a Samaritan town, which didn't welcome them. Just little things to how they all match up. But let's have a thinking about some in the feeding of the 5,000. Mark chapter 6, verse 31. Many were coming and going, and they had no leisure even to eat. Why were many coming and going? Mark doesn't tell us. But if we read John, we find that the Passover, the feast of the Jews, was at hand. It's a time for journeying. Jesus said to Philip, "Where are we to buy bread so that these people may eat?" Philip replies, but then one of Jesus's disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, "There's a boy with, you know, these barley loaves." So we've got Philip and Andrew. Why would Jesus be asking Philip? Was it, you know, Philip's turn to get asked questions that day? And why is Andrew part? Why is he jumping into the action? Well, John doesn't tell us. But Luke tells us that all of this was set apart in the region opposite a town called Bethsaida. But that doesn't help us, does it? Unless we learn that Philip was from Bethsaida, the city of Andrew and Peter. You see, these things, they dovetail together, and yet not in a way which is self-conscious. In a way, it's just they fit together. The information in Luke makes sense of the information in John, and the information in John makes sense of the information in Mark. Mark chapter 6, Jesus commanded them all to sit down in groups on the green grass. Now, for most of us, or certainly for those of us who are born and brought up in this green and pleasant land, you sort of think, well, what other sort of grass is there? Do you know, it's either green, it's grass. Grass is green, isn't it? John tells us there was much grass in the place. And you think, oh, that's what a bizarre thing to say. And yet, if you've travelled in the Middle East, you'll know that green grass and much grass isn't such an obvious and a straightforward thing. Why would they draw attention to this? Does it make sense? We know in John 6 that the Passover, the feast of the Jews, was at hand. We know it was around the time of late March, early April. And we also know that the rainfall in Palestine, in Israel, comes in January, February, March. So what do you get at the end of those 3 months of lots and lots of rain? Lots and lots of grass. And what colour is it? It's green. And if it had all happened in August, there wouldn't have been much of it, and it would have been brown. Because that's how it is. This is just a passing comment, and yet it just shows it all fits together. There's a boy here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish. Well, would you believe it? The barley harvest comes around the time of Passover. Matthew 14:22. Immediately Jesus made the disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side while he dismissed the crowds. Why should Jesus send the disciples away so quickly like that? Why should Jesus send them away? John chapter 6, they were about to come and take him by force to make him king. He needs to get the disciples out of this atmosphere of messianic enthusiasm. Matthew doesn't tell us that, and John doesn't tell us. Do you see the way in which these gospels just fit together in sort of undesigned ways, in little ways, things that you might imagine, and we just have these things. So that's just a sample from our little book. Can we trust the gospels? The gospels are accurate when it comes to geography, even the topology, the shape of the land, the ups and downs. They're accurate in terms of the names they give people, and in fact even in terms of the frequency of the people's names, and in the way in which people are talked about. The people with common names get explained. We see that the authors of the gospels leave their fingerprints in the gospels, and we see from those two particular stories of Zacchaeus and the feeding of the 5,000 how just little things, the sort of things that you wouldn't invent and you couldn't know unless you were telling the story either from first-hand information or from very careful research from people who were there and who saw it. Can we trust the Gospels? The answer is yes. Now, again, we need to realise what we've proved. None of this is proof of the truthfulness of the Gospels, but what it is it's a very robust rejoinder to this idea that they were just made up, that they were just fiction, that they were just invented at a later time in another place, that there are just other Gospels which are just as good, and we just randomly have Matthew, Mark, Luke and John, but we could have had Thomas or Judas or Philip or the Gospel of Mary or whatever it is. People say that, and we can be disconcerted, we can be anxious, we can be unsettled, and we can think, well, maybe what am I right to trust them, am I right to believe them? And the answer is yes, not because of this information. We trust the Gospels because in them we hear God's word, and God is quite able to persuade us of the truthfulness of his word. But we're encouraged and we're settled and we're reassured in our hearts as we see how it all fits together and it all makes sense. So, Andrew, you can finish the recording there.